Hey, you're tuned in to the Verve Podcast live from the heart of Las Vegas, Nevada. Thanks for listening, and viva la Verve!
So when I was in college, during the summer break months, I would work at churches, helping out with the junior high and high school students so that I could gain ministry experience. And so one summer, I was working at a church on the west side of Indianapolis, and I took the kids, all the students, to this giant youth conference, and it was like over 600 miles away. We had to rent those big charter buses to take everybody there, and so we all load in the buses, and we travel across several states, and we just had a great time. It was a really great week, listening to speakers and hearing bands and kind of just getting to know each other better, and most importantly, getting to know God better. And a lot of the kids there took huge strides in their relationship with God. A couple of them gave their lives to Jesus that week. We just had a really, really fun and fantastic week. And so when the week was over, we load up in the buses and we head back home. And I brought home 154 kids that were just on fire for Jesus. Problem. I had taken 155. Yeah, I left a kid there. Let me explain how that happened. So when we were loading up in the buses, I had my adult leaders go and count all the kids. And they came back, and we were one shy. And so I said, okay, that's not good. Go count them again. And so they go and count them again, and this time they come back, and the counts are correct. And so I was a little like, and so I said, okay, go check with their traveling buddy. Make sure that they have their traveling buddy. And here's where the problem came in. Because the kid that we were missing, he came out of the dorm, he brought his luggage down like he was supposed to, he went on the bus, he put his like personal stuff on the bus, then he thought it'd be a really great idea to leave and go back into the dorm and fall asleep. And so when they're going around asking people, his travel buddy sees his stuff on the seat, thinks, oh, he's not here, but he's got to be here, and so he doesn't report him missing. So I go with the counts, and I leave him behind. So about halfway home, I get a call from the head pastor of the church. Apparently, when you leave a kid behind, their parents get a little upset. Thought they overreacted a little bit, but because the funny thing is, actually, the band that was at the conference was actually from like the southern Indiana area. And so when he woke up and came out of the dorm and saw us gone, he found the band and just hitched a ride home with them. He actually made it home before we did. So I don't know what his parents were upset about. I thought, you know, plus I have like a 99% return rate on kids. That's pretty good. So anyway, ever since that experience, I have had like this extreme fear of when I'm leading trips of leaving people behind. So you can imagine my anxiety last year when I took a group of Ververs to Ecuador. We weren't just traveling, you know, via bus. This was going to require like three different flights. And we weren't just going to a couple states over. We were going to a whole new continent. And clearly, I am not the best with details. So, so leading up to that trip, I was so fearful that like I was going to forget something or someone. I did my best to like, you know, cross all my I's and dot my T's or whatever it is we're supposed to do. And so I made sure everything was in place. And so everybody gets to the airport on time. I made sure everybody had their tickets. I made sure everybody had their passports. We get in line to board the first plane, and I make sure I'm the last one to board. I'm like counting them. You know, I think there's like eight of us, so I had enough fingers for that. So everybody makes it on board, and I'm like, cool. And so I'm finally there, and I check in with the agent, and I start heading down the ramp, and I hear the agent calling behind me. And I was like, yeah, what's up? She's like, your carry-on is too big. And I was like, you mean the carry-on that I bought because it says it specifically is the right size to fit on airplanes, it's too big. And she's like, yeah, it's too big. And she said, you're going to need to check it. And so I was like, okay, that's fine. Give me a second. So I need to get some stuff out of there. So I get like a couple books I wanted to read and like my headphones and my iPad, and I get it out of it, and I close it back up, and I hand it to the size guessing challenged agent, and she checks it and takes it away. And it isn't until we're in the air and we're like halfway to Houston, our first stop, that I realize I had put my passport into that bag And the problem is now it's being checked, and it's checked since we were already checked in for our international flight. The bag was going to go straight to Ecuador. And so when we got to Ecuador, so I'd be able to get to Ecuador, but I wouldn't be able to, I wouldn't have my passport to get through customs to get my baggage, and I had to have my bags to get through customs. So in my fear of leaving someone behind, I didn't realize it was me. I was leaving me behind. Well, so I realized I got to fix this. We get to Houston. I book it out to the customer service people. I'm like, you got to help me. They're like, we can't do anything. They're like, maybe if you go talk to the baggage claim people. So I race out of security. I go to the baggage claim people, and I explain the situation. And seriously, like, you know when you're like super frantic, you're like, you got to help me, da-da-da. And they're like, okay. Like, so they're moving with all the expediency of a snail. And I'm sitting there like biting my fingernails. And I think we had like a 3-hour-ish layover in Houston. And seriously, it took like 2 hours and 55 minutes for me to be able to convince somebody to meet me at the gate and to get my bag so that I could have my passport. But they finally did. I made it. And with like moments of spare, I got my passport. Yeah. So thank you for clapping at my stupidity. I really appreciate that. This builds up the confidence. So I was talking with a couple of the people that went on that trip to Ecuador this week about like what maybe some of their fears that they had about going to a foreign country. And some of them had fears of, you know, being away from their family for so long. Others had fears of like the language barrier and how that was going to be tough to get over. One person had a fear of like getting bit by a weird bug that was going to give them like some disease that would like grow a third arm. That was me. That was my fear, actually. But we all had our fears, right? But yet, we all went, and it was a really amazing trip. Here at Verve, we've partnered with a group of other churches who built us a church and like this educational facility in a town in Ecuador called Roca Fuerte. And so our group went, and we built them a playground set, and it was just a really, really great trip. Best part was we got to meet some of the kids that we financially support through a company called Compassion International. Compassion International is an organization that just helps kids in poverty. It provides economic relief and medical attention and, most importantly, spiritual direction for kids living in poverty around the world. If something like that, if that interests you, check out their website, compassion.com, or on your way out, stop by the Velcro bar back there. The people back there will know more and have more information about this if that's something you'd like to check more out. But anyway, so all of us, you know, we all kind of had our own fears, but I think you'd be hard-pressed to find anybody that went on that trip and ask them and that they didn't have the time of their life. It was just a really, really great experience. And that's kind of interesting, right? Because you know, oftentimes when we look back on our lives and when we ask ourselves, you know, what were the best experiences, often they're the ones we're most fearful of, right? I mean, I still remember standing backstage with my dad, getting ready to walk out and meet my wife to marry her, right? And I mean, I was scared to death. It was the same thing when I was becoming a dad. I didn't know what I was doing. I was scared to death, right? Or when I quit my job and decided to go into business for myself. And I went 6 months without having a paycheck. Whew, I was scared. But right now, I'll tell you, it was one of the best decisions I ever made. And I bet the same would be true for the guy that we're talking about today. The series, Lion Chasers, it comes from a story in the Bible, in the book of 2 Samuel. And it's a story about a guy named Benaiah. And so we're gonna read his story here. It's found in Samuel chapter 23. If you have your Bibles, turn to 2 Samuel chapter 23. We are going to start with verse 20. If you didn't bring a Bible with you, don't worry about it. We'll put the verses that I'm going to read up on the screen behind me so you can follow along. Before I read, though, if you didn't bring a Bible because you don't own a Bible, or like the Bible that you own sounds like it was written in the 1700s by Bill Shakespeare, stop by the Velcro bar on your way out. We have a stack of easy-to-read Bibles back there. Grab one. They're completely free. You can just go up and grab one and take it home with you and start reading it. So here we go. 2 Samuel chapter 23. We're going to start with verse 20. Benaiah, son of Jehoiada, a valiant fighter from Kabzeel, performed great exploits. He struck down Moab's two mightiest warriors. He also went down into a pit on a snowy day and killed a lion. And he struck down a huge Egyptian. Although the Egyptian had a spear in his hands, Benaiah went against him with a club, and he snatched the spear from the Egyptian's hand, and he killed him with his own spear. Yeah. Such were the exploits of Benaiah, son of Jehoiada. So this story, this idea of being a lion chaser, comes from this dude that we read about right here. And I don't know about you, but man, this guy sounds awesome, right? He is like the original B.A. Baracus, right? He goes face to face with this huge Egyptian, and he's only got a little stick. That dude has a spear, but he hits him with a stick, grabs a spear, and then kills him with his own weapon. That is awesome. Or this other warring tribe that they're that they were against, they send out their two best MMA heavyweight and middleweight champions, right? And this guy takes them on 2-on-1, and he kills both of those dudes. And then he finds himself in a pit with a lion on a snowy day, and he doesn't run away. I don't know about you, that's exactly what I'd do, but he doesn't run away. He runs, but he runs into the pit, and he leaves with what I imagine was a pretty sweet-looking rug for his house. So Benaiah was a part of the ancient kingdom of Israel. He lived about 1,000 years before Jesus comes on the scene. The king of Israel was a guy named David. This is King David, the same guy that killed the giant when he was a young boy, like David and Goliath, right? That's the same guy. Now he's all grown up and he's king. And he was so enthralled by the exploits of this guy, Benaiah, that he hires Benaiah to be the head of his bodyguards. So like the people responsible for protecting the life of the king, the king's looking and says, I want you to be like him. I want you to be the guy that runs into the pit on a snowy day with the lion. And what's interesting is we know all of this because David is dying. We actually have recorded for us in the first part of 2 Samuel chapter 23, the last words of King David. And so then he's kind of going on about the exploits of the men that served under him. And you know, that's kind of natural, right? Like, I think at the end of our lives, we're all going to have moments where we kind of sit back and we reflect on the people and the places that we've been and the things we've been a part of. And researchers, they've actually studied this. And they say that, yeah, that's exactly what people do. But what they found is that the number one thing people have at the end of their life is regrets. The number one thing they talk about when they're reflecting are their regrets. And what's interesting about that is the things that they regret aren't actually the things they've done. The things that they regret are all the things they didn't do. That's the thing they talk about. And it's not even close. Like 86% of the regrets that people talk about when they're on their deathbed are all the regrets of the things they didn't do. And look, I'm sure that we all have things we wish we wouldn't have done, right? We all have times that we left a kid 600 miles away from their parents' house, right? We all can relate with that. But the truth is, when we get to the end of our lives, that's not the things we're going to regret. I don't regret that at all. The things we're going to regret are the things we didn't do. And so why don't we do this? Well, because of fear. We don't do it because we're scared. Kind of like, it's like our minds are our computer, and we have this computer virus in our heads. And we have these infected files, these irrational fears and misconceptions that keep us from living the way that God intended for us to live, the way we were designed to live. And if somehow we don't manage to go in and uninstall those misconceptions, they can undermine everything that we do. Do you know that? According to psychiatric reference books, there's approximately 2,000 categorized and classified fears, phobias, right? Like arachnophobia, that's the fear of spiders, right? Do you know what acrophobia is? Like an acrobatic fear of heights, yeah. Or aerophobia is the fear of flying. There's some other phobias that are like not as well known, like genophobia. The fear of knees. That's why I wore pants today, in case any of you were suffering from this. I don't want to freak you out. There's actually a phobia called francophobia. It's the fear of French people. There's Dutch phobia, which is the fear of Dutch people. Yeah, there's even Kentucky phobia, which is the fear of, and it's actually the fear of marrying your sister. I'm just kidding. But you, okay, we're done. So out of all those 2,000 phobias, those 2,000 classified fears, did you know you're only born with two of them? You're only born with two of them. The only two fears that you have innately built into you are the fear of falling and the fear of loud noises. Kind of like a survival instinct, right? That makes sense. Every other fear, the 1,998 other phobias that we have classified, they're all learned. They're all learned. And what's great about that is if it's a fear that's been learned, it's a fear that can be unlearned. Take my kids, for instance, right? My daughter, she loves to swim. And now she's just a fish. Like, she learned to swim a couple years ago, and then she gets around a pool, and she just wants to, like, dive right in. She's putting the goggles on. She's doing, I mean, she wants to be in the pool all the time. She has no fear. As a matter of fact, yesterday we were at a friend's house. I snapped this picture yesterday. She was playing in the pool, and she saw all the older kids, like the 10, 11, 12-year-olds going up on that rock formation and jumping out. And she's in the pool, and she's like, oh, I can do that. And my 5-year-old little daughter just runs up and just starts doing it. Doesn't ask, doesn't say, Dad, is this okay? She just said, man, I'm going to do this. She has no fear. And my son, my 3-year-old son, he was the same way. He loved the pool. He loved to be in Mimi and Papa's pool. He loved to splash around right up until a couple of months ago. And he was standing on the step of the pool, and he decided, oh, I'm going to see if I can float. And he took a step off, and bloop, just went right under. Now, thankfully, his Mimi was right there. She saw him. She grabbed him. It was never serious or anything. But he swallowed, you know, a big gulp full of water, and now he's different. Now he doesn't like to go in the pool. Why? Because he's scared. Because it scared him. He learned fear. He wasn't born with that. His natural instinct was to enjoy the water. But now that fear is stopping him from doing something that he can totally accomplish. And it's not natural, but it happens all the time. Because see, when we learn, half of learning is learning, right? But then the other half of learning is actually unlearning. And unfortunately, unlearning is twice as hard as learning. It's like when you're driving down the freeway and you miss the exit, you gotta go another mile, get off, and come back. Unlearning is really, it takes twice as long, and it's often twice as hard. It's a lot harder to get old thoughts out of your head than it is to put new thoughts into your head. I remember my first day on the job of building houses for a home builder here in Las Vegas. I had no idea what I was doing. I've never done anything like that before. I was mostly used to leaving kids away from their parents. But I told I was told to go meet my boss at this certain, you know, job site and show up, and he'd tell me what to do. So I go and I meet him, and he's this real burly construction worker guy named Robert. And, you know, I introduced myself, and I'm sure he just looked me up and down and could tell I was as green as St. Patrick's Day, man. I had no idea what I was doing. And he asked me, you know, with his cigarette hanging out of his mouth and his hands that were seriously made of sandpaper or something, he says, you know, have you ever built a house before? And I said, well, you know, I used to build some blanket forts back when I was a kid. It's pretty sweet. No, I said, no, I have no idea what I'm doing. And I'll never forget what he said. He said, great. I'm glad you don't know what you're doing, so I don't have to teach you all out of all of your bad habits. I don't have to make you unlearn all those wrong ways that you have done something. I think that's why Jesus actually worked so hard to kind of help our brains reset. It's like he knew our brains had that virus in them, and so it was kind of his job to come and help us to unlearn all of that stuff. I mean, if you read some of the stories about Jesus, if you read the Bible and the parts that talk about the life of Jesus, he was all the time saying things like you have heard that it was said something, 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 but I tell you this. You learned it this way, but now I need to help you unlearn it like this. Like for instance, one time he was talking about revenge. He said, you've heard that it was said an eye for an eye and a tooth for tooth. But I tell you, let me unlearn you here. Do not resist an evil person. If anyone slaps you on the right cheek, turn to them the other as well. Or when he taught about anger, you have heard that it was said, to the people long ago, you shall not murder. Anyone who commits murder will be subject to judgment. But I tell you that anyone who is angry with a brother or sister will be subject to judgment. Or when he was talking about people that you don't really like, right? He says, you have heard that it was said, love your neighbor and hate your enemy. But I tell you, love your enemies. Pray for those who persecute you. It seems like Jesus was all the time kind of addressing our minds, addressing these things that we've learned and teaching us that we need to unlearn them. It's interesting that the Bible teaches us that when we choose to follow Jesus, one of the things that he changes is our mind. It says this in the book of Romans chapter 12. It says, therefore, I urge you, brothers and sisters, in view of God's mercy, it means in view of what Jesus has done for you, offer your bodies as a living sacrifice, holy and pleasing to God. This is your true and proper worship. Check this out. Do not conform to the pattern of this world, but be transformed. So change, be transformed by the renewing of your mind. And then you will be able to test and approve what God's will is, his good, pleasing, and perfect will. It says, for us to be able to determine what God wants us to do, for us to be able to tell what God's will is for us in our lives, it takes a transformation. It means we have to change, but what needs to change is our mind. Our minds need to be renewed. That when it comes to being a lion chaser, to being people who chase after these big dreams that God has put inside of us, often we tend to stop before we ever get started because we've learned fear. But God promises us a new mind so we can unlearn our fears. There's a really cool scene in that great philosophical movie, Star Wars Episode 5, where Yoda and Luke are in training, right? Luke wanted to leave and he wanted to go help his friends out. And so to prevent this, Yoda had used the force to pick up his fighter jet and move it into the swamp and sink it like in the swamp. And so he's been training with Luke and he's been teaching him how to use the force, how to recognize that. And Luke has been successful using it to like raise little stones off the ground and stuff like that. And so finally, Yoda tells him, okay, well then now lift your fighter jet out of the swamp there. And Luke says, I can't do it. He says, I can lift rocks, but this is different. And Yoda says, no different, only different in your mind. And he says, sorry, that's the best I could do. I'm sorry. He says, hey, you guys are generous, man. He says, you must unlearn what you have learned. And so Yoda then proceeds to show him up and he lifts it out and he sets it down in front of Luke. And Luke says, I don't believe it. And Yoda says, and that is why you fail. See, I think the two biggest tricks that evil uses to neutralize our spirituality are discouragement and fear. We learn those fears and then we allow those fears to keep us from becoming lion chasers, to keep us from recognizing the truth about ourselves, and it stops us from being lion chasers. We say, I can't make a difference. I'm just one person. What can I do? I don't have any money. Anytime I try anything, I always screw it up. I'm a failure. But that's not the truth. The truth is, you are a son or daughter of God. The truth is, your life, with all of its mistakes and all of its failures, your life was so valuable, it was purchased by God on the cross through his son, Jesus Christ. And if you let him, if you will surrender your life to the life that he desires for you, you know what happens? Those fears, they go away. Check this out. It's in 1 John. 1 John chapter 4. Says this, 1 John 4, starting in verse 16. It says, and so we know and rely on the love God has for us. God is love. And whoever lives in love lives in God and God in them. And this is how love is made complete among us so that we will have confidence on the day of judgment. In this world, we are like Jesus. There is no fear in love. Check this out. But perfect love drives out fear. because fear has to do with punishment. The one who fears is not made perfect in love. But we love because he first loved us. Man, did you catch that? Perfect love drives out fear. Part of the goal in coming into a relationship with God is that he drives out fear. And part of the problem, and we talked about this last week. If this is your first week here, I encourage you to go on our website and check out last week's service online. It was the first week of this series, so you can kind of go through in order because they kind of build on each other. Because we talked about last week, the problem is that we believe the lie that we are here and that we're all alone, that we are so very small. But what we fail to realize is that the God who lives inside of us, whose love is inside of us, is so much bigger than the world we live in. See, to cure our fears, the cure to overcoming our fears is to face them. It's to face those fears. And we can have confidence doing that, even if we are afraid. Because our fears, they're just finite. But the God who's inside of us is infinite. I think most of us, for better or for worse, our lives are going to be shaped and defined by just a few experiences. Kind of like Benaiah with those three experiences. Most of us are going to have these defining moments in our lives. And those moments, they can plant a seed of confidence or a seed of doubt. They can plant a seed of hope or a seed of helplessness, a seed of faith or a seed of fear. I told you earlier about my son and this fear of water that he suddenly had. So you know what we did? We made him get back in. My wife, she picked him up in her arms and she grabbed him and she carried him back down into the water. And you know what? He wailed and screamed the whole way. But eventually, he knew he was safe. He could feel my wife's loving arms around her. And so I'm sure that my wife felt a little bit foolish carrying her screaming son into the pool. But she knew something he didn't know. She knew all of the fun that he was going to be forfeiting if he allowed those fears to get the best of him. And so clinging to my wife, my son faced those fears. And I think sometimes God does that with us, right? Like I think often it's easy to go through life and be kind of comfortable, and when those times happen, we tend to kind of distance ourselves from God. And so I think, and I believe from time to time, God allows us to go through situations that can be quite fearful, because it's in those situations when we can feel his arms around us. It's when we face those fears that we can begin to unlearn them. So I know at least for me, when I get to the end of my life, when I'm reflecting of all those things, I don't want to feel like I got to the end of my life as comfortably as possible. I don't want to feel like I ran from everything that I was afraid of. And I think if you set Benaiah down at the end of his life, and you asked him, man, what were those moments in your life that scared you the most? I think he'd say, oh, man, that time I was outnumbered 2-1. Or the time that I faced that giant Egyptian with just a stick and he had a spear. Or probably the time that I met that beast in a pit on a snowy day. And then I think if you ask him, well what were the most exhilarating moments of your life? What was the moment when the moment in your life when you felt most alive? You know what I think he'd say? It was that time I was outnumbered 2-1. It was the Egyptian giant. It was the day that I became a lion chaser. You see, Benaiah, he lived the kind of life that we tell stories about. I mean, even now, we're 3,000 years later, we're telling the story of a man who went into that pit. And look, I'm certain that Benaiah was scared. I'm sure when he met that beast, there was a little bit of pee running down that leg, right? I'm certain of it. But he also didn't want to miss what turned out to be the most defining moment of his life. So what about you? Now listen, I don't want you to head out of here and go down to San Diego and jump a fence and get into a lion pit. And then most of all, if you do that, I don't want you to say, my pastor told me to do this. Please don't do that. But I am going to guess that there are a few of you here today who are ready. There are a few of you who have lived your life long enough running from your fears that you're ready to begin to unlearn them. You're ready to face those, to allow God's love to permeate your life and drive out those fears. And for some of you, and for some of you, that means taking a step in faith towards a relationship with God. Maybe you've been coming here to Verve for a couple of weeks, and you've been listening to this life that God so desperately wants to give to you. And you haven't just been listening here, you've been listening deep down in your soul, and that place where only you can hear, and you've been hearing him say some things to you. Maybe it's time. Maybe it's time to take that step. And look, I get it. When you do that, there are fears involved. I mean, what if he asks you to change? What if he asks you to give some stuff up? What if he asks you to quit your job? What if he asks you to move? What if he asks for some of your money? What if he asks you to give up drinking or to give up your sex life? What if he does? And look, those fears, they're probably pretty legitimate fears, because you know what? He probably will. If you're finding your identity in anything other than the thing God wants you to find your identity in, which is him, he's probably going to try to renew your mind, to transform your life. But you want to know something? You want to hear a secret? That is when you find true life. When you surrender yourself over to the grace of God. When you allow your body and your mind and your soul to be transformed, that is when you find the kind of life that he is trying to give you. That is when you find the kind of life that goes on mission trips to Ecuador and builds churches in poverty-stricken countries. That's when you find the kind of life that reaches out to inner-city schools here in Las Vegas and makes the world a better place by turning the lives of some of those teachers upside down and giving them care packages. That's where you find the kind of life that actually makes a dent in sex trafficking. That's the kind of life that can help addicts, that can comfort victims with AIDS. You can live that kind of life. You can become a lion chaser. You do not have to let fear get the best of you. You can unlearn fear, and you do it through God's love. And when you do that, that's when you discover who you really are, that you are a lion chaser put on this earth by God to make a difference in this world for him. That's when you turn the world upside down. And that's the kind of story that they're going to be writing about 3,000 years from now. So I want to give you a moment to think about that. Every week we just take a moment to pause, and kind of before we leave this place and before we go back to our normal lives, and give it a moment just to allow God to do something with that. And so during this time, I'm going to invite the band to come back up, and they're going to play a song. And you know, maybe you just want to sit there and maybe try praying if you've never prayed before. Or we'll throw the lyrics of the song up on the screen. You can just kind of sit there and read those and think about what that means for you. And during this time, we'll also have communion available. And communion is a piece of bread and a cup of juice that we use every week to remind us of the sacrifice that Jesus made for us so that we could have the life that he wants to give us. And so if you'd like to make that a part of your experience today, you can find that on the candlelit tables around the room, and you can do that during this song as well. So I'm going to pray, and the band's going to make their way up. God, most of the time when I'm up here talking, I feel like I'm talking more to myself than to my friends sitting out here listening to me. Because God, I know and you know how often I allow fears to stop me from doing or being the way that you desire me to be. And so God, I I'm sorry when I don't believe you. I'm sorry when I don't take your word at face value, that when we allow your love to penetrate our hearts, it drives out those fears, because you are way bigger than anything else in this world. And so, God, I pray that this morning we would allow you to transform us by renewing our minds, by unlearning fear. And we give all that to you in the name of your Son. And in his name we pray. Amen.